Erica Schickel believes that she wasn't born a bad girl. She had badness thrust upon her. Growing up in the shadow of her famous film critic father and her beautiful but dispirited mother, Schickel struggled to find her own identity. She was bright but lacked confidence. She had talent as a writer and actress, but no direction. When her parents' nasty divorce sent Schickel into a tailspin of self-destructive behavior, she was shipped off to a supposed safe haven, Buxton School, a bohemian boarding school in the Berkshires. For Schickel, it was out of the frying pan and into the fire. During her senior year, she was seduced by her teacher, thrown out of school, and branded a disgrace. Long before the rise of the Me Too movement, she was one of many victims of the 1970s culture that promoted the sexualization and exploitation of young girls. Over 25 years, Schickel would once again find herself in a cycle of scandal and exile over a scandalous relationship with an older man. The Big Hurt, a memoir, is a coming-of-age story in two parts. As a precocious teen forced to grow up too fast, she fell victim to predators and the culture that empowered and protected them. As an adult attempting to reckon with her past, she inadvertently recreated by destroying her marriage over a passionate affair with an infamous L.A. crime writer. Again, the name of the book is The Big Hurt, and it is a great pleasure to welcome Erica Schickel to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Joe. Thank you for having me.
A great pleasure to have you on the program. What brought you to want to tell this story?
Well, half of the story I have wanted to tell my whole life. The earlier part of the story, which is about how I was seduced by a teacher in my private Massachusetts boarding school 6 weeks before graduation of my senior year. The affair was discovered, the teacher was fired, and I was expelled. I always knew that was a story I needed to tell. And then the second half of the story sort of came up by accident and threw the whole thing off kilter.
And throwing it off kilter, did that impede, or that did impede, you telling the story of why it took so long to tell?
Yes. The second part of the story is about how in middle age, when I was in my 40s, I decided it was time to write this book about what happened to me in boarding school, and I had conceived it as a humor memoir. And because I was living with the story of what happened to me as anecdote, I could not embrace it. And then I had to in order to write the book, and it was what I discovered was a past of neglect and abandonment and abuse that was so upsetting that it felt easier to engage an affair with a notorious crime writer than it was to actually confront my past. And so that's what I did. And as I was negotiating that relationship, I became aware that what I had done was recreate the exact circumstances of what had happened to me in high school, and that these two stories were in fact one story.
If people know your story, they know that the crime writer was James Ellroy, but you don't say
yeah.
that directly.
No, I don't. And I'm not shy about it because he's written about me and using my names extensively. But, you know, the reason I made up a different name for him and gave him the ridiculous name of Sam Spade,
right.
A famous detective from noir fiction, Raymond Chandler's books, you know, just because it was an obvious tell and because it's so easy to Google and find out who he was. But I gave him that name because the book isn't about him, you know, and I didn't, you know, celebrities have a way of just sort of sucking all the air out of the room. And I needed this not to be about him. So that's why I changed the name. Not to be cute about it, but just to
right.
keep the reader focused on the story.
And keeping the reader focused on the story also keeps the reader focused on what you went through, right? I mean, what you personally, the pain that was caused and that you felt.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of stakes in this book. And there certainly are romantic stakes. There are familial stakes at play in this book. But one of the stakes is my struggle to tell this story, to come out from under the shadow of great literary men, not only James Ellroy, but my father, who was the film critic Richard Schickel, a very prolific and admired figure in the world of writing and film criticism. And the fight, the struggle for me was to keep this story about me and to tell it on my terms. And, you know, not to be too highfalutin about it, but, you know, that's a struggle for women in our society. You know, our stories get so subsumed by the male story. And I really wanted that to be the part of my arc, is like claiming my voice and getting this book made. So, yeah.
So a lot to talk about. Let us begin with the Buxton School, and it is a private school in our region in Williamstown, Massachusetts.
Yes, it is.
So what brought you to that school, and ultimately, how did you look at that time? And you're expelled, and yet you are the one who was preyed upon.
Yeah, and just to be clear, you know, they couldn't actually legally expel me because I was still their responsibility at that point. But they asked me very strongly to leave and told me that if I remained in the school, it would upset the other students and the teacher's wife who wanted to be there to finish the semester. So I was sacrificed for that. And yeah, you know, the repercussions of that and the guilt and the shame that followed me through the years after that were profound.
How did your family react to it, and how much did they know at the time of what had happened?
Yeah, well, I mean, I came to the school because my family had no idea what to do with me. You know, they were both my parents were professional, self-obsessed, damaged people, and they found themselves with an recalcitrant teenager on their hands and they were divorcing, having a bitter, toxic divorce. So I was getting into some trouble. You know, I was a headstrong kid, and that's why they sent me to boarding school, because they just didn't want to deal with me. My father reacted very negatively. He wouldn't have anything to do with me. My mother, with whom I had been very estranged for years, actually embraced me in that moment and identified with me because, as it turned out, she too had had an affair with her college professor back in the 50s. And that was an affair that had marked her for life. And I never really understood it until I came into adulthood and started writing this book, that I was carrying out a sort of epigenetic legacy of shame.
Not that it matters, because the trauma is the trauma and the act is horrible regardless, but how old were you and how old was the teacher?
I was 2 months past my 18th birthday when the affair started, and he was, I think, 33 years old.
When you decide that you want to write about it, and as you say, you knew that you were going to tell that story, so what was it like to finally get it out, to look at it? Was that illuminating, looking at what happened there and understanding how it fit into the greater puzzle of your life?
You know, because it took me 12 years to write the book, you know, at first, as I began to examine the story, it sort of started to disgorge its demons, you know, and I just felt overwhelmed by it. But I kept at it on and off. A lot of the stuff described in the book, you know, Sam Spade's meltdown and drug abuse and our very dramatic and intense relationship. My kids were in duress. I had two daughters at that time. One is now non-binary, but at the time I had two children, and I am the eldest of two girls. So them coming of age really triggered a lot of stuff for me. So it was a slow and very painful process. And the deeper I went, the bigger the picture became. Like, I saw an almost fractal pattern in this story, where each part of the story sort of touched on and related to another, even across decades. And that was one of the things I really tried to do, is to not just keep it focused solely on me and my experience, but to draw out from it and let my reader understand sort of the structure of abuse and how all of this happened at that time.
Erica Schickel is our guest on the roundtable this morning. The new book is The Big Hurt. The Big Hurt is, there are many of them in this book. I mean, overall abuse, but there are many hurts in this book.
Yeah, there really are. And it's funny, The Big Hurt, as my readers will discover early on in the book, is I stole the title from James Ellroy, who was writing a memoir about his obsession with women. And originally he was going to call it The Big Hurt. And then he ended up calling it The Hilliker Curse and dedicating the book to me. And I used the title because for me, you know, The Big Hurt is that trauma. And a lot of that trauma happens at home in our families. And all of the romantic hurt that followed in the wake was really more about the hurt around my mother. You know, at the end, that is our first love, our first great love. And if that love doesn't get reflected consistently, it is just total heartbreak for the child. And that's the thing that was dogging me my whole life that I couldn't understand until I started writing this book in my 40s was, oh my God, my mother got rid of me. That's what's been hurting me all these years. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. So there are many hurts addressed in the book, but I think that's really just the central one, is the loss of self that we have when we lose our mothers at a young age. And coincidentally, that was also Ellroy's big hurt. You know, his mother was famously murdered when he was 10 years old. But both of us were looking for our beautiful pale-skinned, red-headed mothers, you know, to love us again. And that was our bond. It was a trauma bond, and it was very powerful, very powerful.
I just have to admit to the audience that I find it interesting/odd interviewing you, because I've had your dad on the show a bit ago and James Ellroy on the show within the last year.
Yeah.
It's just the nature of what we do.
Sure.
Because they write books and you talk to them, just like I'm talking to you about your book. So now I don't know what to make of either of them.
Well, unfortunately, my father's dead now. So he's gone and I need to reckon with that. I love him deeply and I see him, warts and all, and I understand the mistakes he made, and he was the parent who consistently loved me. So I'm grateful to have had him. You know, and Ellroy, I mean, you know, there will be no closure there. I mean, he himself said, and I quoted in the book, closure is a shuck. And it's true. I mean, there's no such thing. I don't think I'll ever see him or speak to him again. And I don't think that there's a great deal of animosity between us at this point, you know, even though the way that he treated me in the relationship was terrible and so forth. I understand that we were both dealing with our pain and our trauma and trying to work it out through the relationship, which failed because he couldn't go far enough in it.
Yeah.
But, you know.
Two things. One about your father. What was the nature of your relationship at his passing?
Well, alas, my father fell to dementia in the last years of his life. So the last years of his life were very difficult physically, mentally, and emotionally for our family. You know, he was in denial of what was happening to him, and I had to watch sort of his long, slow decline and trying to argue him into some health care, which he always refused. So he was very difficult right up to the end. I mean, and in the end, it was a good relationship. I mean, we loved each other. We disagreed about many things, and he was a difficult man, but, you know, the love was definitely there.
When you think about the overall, this big hurt being the loss of your, the relationship and the loss with your mother, what Do you ever come to terms with that?
I have come to terms with it, you know, through the offices of writing this book and therapy and growing up. And, you know, and I did a lot of my growing up in my 40s, you know, a lot of my growing up got sort of delayed by that incident. So, you know, yeah, I'm at peace with it now because I understand it. And yet there will always be a part of me that wants her mother, you know,
right.
I mean, and wants that love, that sort of, I mean, you know, skin to skin, I am you, you are me, that thing that we experienced and that I had taken away from me too young. So, you know, I don't know if I'll ever figure that part of it out, honestly.
Erica Schickel is our guest, and the name of the book is The Big Hurt. This three generations of trauma, you leave Buxton and then you learn that your mother and your great aunt were also victims of sexual predators by mm-hmm. their teachers. What does that go, how does that play into your processing of what you personally went through? I mean, this basically goes back to what we were talking about at the beginning of keeping the story mm-hmm. on you. And how that fit in to not only your story, but the personal family history, too.
Yeah, I mean, I really did have to process it, and I did come to understand it. And one of the things that I learned from it, it really gave me a great sort of view of the way sexual abuse has been treated and changed over generations. So, for instance, in my great aunt Frances's generation, and that was turn of the 20th century in Western Seattle, she, we will put in scare quotes, fell in love with her English teacher at the age of 16. And her parents were Methodists, and they approved the relationship, and they allowed her to marry her teacher at the age of 16. Because social mores were absolutely just different then. Now that would be seen as a completely inappropriate relationship. Similarly, with my mother, who was over 18, but involved with a professor and his wife at Sarah Lawrence for several years ongoing, you know, that was the 50s. So there was no approval from the parents. There was only secrecy and shame around it. I mean, she only told me when I was in her situation at 18 about it, but she never really talked about it. And she always kept the relationship framed as something romantic, which is sort of what people do to justify sexual and emotional abuse, you know, and for many years for me, I thought I had fallen in love with that teacher and that was a romantic and that it was my fault for being a bad, dirty girl that was allowed to happen. And it really wasn't until I was in my 40s that I came to understand that something had been done to me, you know, and as I started writing this book, the hashtag #MeToo began. And I remember seeing that as I was writing. And I still felt resistant to it. Like, I never wanted to think of myself as a victim. Because I'm a sort of abandoned child, that means I am the captain of my own beautiful, bold ship. You know, that's
right.
The framework that I lived with. So in order to absorb the victim role, I really had to change my thinking around it and accept that was criminal, what happened to me.
That's fascinating because I've heard that from other victims who have said that while they are appreciative of the movement, that they weren't always ready to embrace it because it seemed odd to have their experience sort of condensed into a hashtag.
Yes. Yeah. It's very difficult. I mean, again, it's two sides on that coin. Liberating, I'm so glad that the conversation is finally out in the open about what's happening in private schools, in the Catholic Church, in the Boy Scout troops, wherever children are left to the offices of non-parental adults, you know, that's a recipe for abuse. So I'm really, really glad that the conversation has changed around this, and I can now say, yes, I was the victim of something, but I still cling to the mast of my ship.
But you also were a part of getting that story out about Buxton. I mean, that as that story started to explode, if you will, you were part of the narrative in that story of saying, yes, I can attest this is what happened.
Yeah, and really what kicked that off was in 2011, I think it was, the Boston Globe Spotlight team did a huge expose on sexual abuse in private prep schools. And the feature that they did on me was about instances where schools retaliated against the victims. Mm. So I found myself on the front page of the Sunday Boston Globe with this article. And what was very strange about it is the article came and went, and nobody from Buxton, I mean, all these years later, nobody reached out to me to say, oh, Lord, Erica, we weren't there then, but we see you, we apologize, this was terrible, nothing. And then a few years later, there was an email chain among alumni in which I just sort of came out to these other students of mine, friends of mine, about what had happened, and it sort of exploded, and a letter was written to the school asking for redress, and the headmaster sort of immediately wrote back and sort of described these as romantic relationships, you know, a sort of gaslighty, awful letter. And then the alumni all rose up against that. And now they have a policy where they're working they've done a sort of general apology, nothing to me personally. And now there's a fund has been set up so that students who have been abused can get some counseling. But that does me no good. I mean, I've had 30 years of counseling. And they're not going to pay for that retroactively. So in the end, I'm still left high and dry by that school. And, you know, at least I was able to write the book.
What would satisfy you in hearing from them? What could they say that would give you some satisfaction?
Oh, you know, Erica Schickel, what happened to you in our school was wrong. That was an abuse of our power. We regret that. Please know that you are a beloved and respected member of our community. I mean, that's all it would take.
I was going to say, that doesn't seem like much.
Doesn't seem like much, does it? But of course, you know, that leaves them open to, you know, legal stuff. The wording is very careful in their official letter, you know.
Yeah.
They don't actually accept any blame or guilt for anything.
The book is very interestingly and ingeniously constructed, the way you go back and forth in time. At what point did you realize that that was the way to tell the story of hopscotching around to different times, different decades, different families?
Well, that part of it, that was really hard. And you know, part of it was the Buxton story was sort of encased in amber. And so I could sort of write about that more easily than the Elroy stuff, which was happening concurrently. But then I realized in the middle of my affair with Elroy that this was the same story, that what I was living through was sort of this part two of what happened to me at Buxton, and that they had to be one book. But really, they were two books, you know. And so this toggle structure that I came up with, you know, is my attempt to sort of knit this into one big coherent story that is about a thing, not just about events.
You also, I mean, at the end, you start to talk about that you were alone for several years after James Elroy.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a difficult time as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And those were the years in which my parents were both dying. So I was very, you know, and I was engaged in a toxic divorce of my own. My parents were ill and dying, and my children were in duress. So I had to, there was just a lot going on in that scenario, and I had to just take it a beat at a time, you know.
The person that you had the relationship with, you still alive, correct?
I believe he is, yeah. I've never spoken with him since. And he declined to be interviewed for the Boston Globe interview. And here's the interesting thing, too, is that, you know, he was at that in my senior year at Buxton, simultaneously teaching at Bennington College, which is just right over the border,
right,
as your audience will know. And he continued to teach there 4 years after, because Buxton never bothered to call Bennington and let them know that they had a predator on their faculty. So, you know, there were no repercussions, as far as I know, for him. And again, you know, the victim is made to bear the burden of their abuse, straight up what it is.
You write that sometimes I fantasized about driving up to Bennington and ambushing him in the Blue Bend Diner where we used to eat breakfast. I would stand before him in that crowded place and I would ask him why he had to hurt me like that. And
yeah. And
that's really the question, I guess, throughout this book, of why you had to be hurt like that.
And why does anybody have to be hurt like that? And, you know, it comes down to just, you know, that sort of little line that people use, like, hurt people, hurt people. And that, I mean, in the end, and this is really the final thing that I want to say about this book, is we need to have compassion for hurt people. You know, I mean, even monsters, you know, who we don't need to embrace their actions, but we need to understand that this comes out of trauma. My mother had been traumatized. James Ellroy had been deeply traumatized. It is not about character. It is about something way deeper than that. And this is what I wanted to explain in my book. Like, let us have compassion for hurt people and help them find a path towards healing. That's all we can possibly hope for with this kind of illness and hurt.
The name of the book is The Big Hurt. The cover is a picture of you with sunglasses on, and you're giving the finger to the camera.
Yeah, that was in the shot in the dorm, yeah.
Do you still feel like, is that still a feeling you have, that even in this book is sort of, yeah, giving the finger?
The flipping of the bird to the whole construct, absolutely. You know,
yeah.
I do still feel that way. You know, I was just being a rebellious little dick in that, you know, moment in that picture. Like, you know, my roommate was like,
but anger,
geez,
but fueled,
you know?
But fueled by anger that I assume still exists within you.
Yeah, I mean, yes, I try not to be consumed by anger. I'm not an angry person. But it is important to be angry on one's own behalf. And it is important when we are dealing with lifelong hurt. It is important to go back and reparent your inner child. Again, it sounds hokey, but the biggest win for me in writing this book was going back and loving that girl, that poor, lost, confused, abandoned girl who was making all these terrible choices because nobody was giving her any guidance, and who had to mistake sex and romance for the love that she was missing in her life. That was all I was given in those years. So, you know, yeah, let's ease up on each other. Let's hold each other to task for the wrongs that we do, but understand that so much of the pain in this world just comes from brokenhearted children who grow up into wounding adults, you know?
Are you happy now?
Yeah, as anyone can be. And, you know, I mean, the world is on fire and things are very, very dark right now. But in terms of my own life and my inner experience of myself, yeah, I'm pretty much at peace now and so grateful to have this book out and to be able to talk about it and to, you know, bring this message forward.
Erica Schickel, I thank you so much for sharing with us and for talking with me this morning. The name of the book is The Big Hurt, a memoir. It is published by Hachette. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you so much, Joe. What a pleasure.
You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.